Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Kirk Megu, host of New Books in Politics. I also host my own podcast called Independent Thought and Freedom, where I interview some of the most interesting people from around the world who are shaking up politics, economics, society, and ideas. You can find it in the iTunes Store or any of your favorite podcast providers. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel. Are you an academic who wants to get heard nationally? Check out my free training on how to use your intellectual authority to do so at becomeapublicintellectual.com. That's becomeapublicintellectual.com. You'll find the link below. And now, onto this week's episode. My guest today is Douglas Murray, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity, published by Bloomsbury Continuum in 2019. Douglas Murray is an author and journalist based in Britain. Murray has been a contributor to The Spectator since 2000 and has been associate editor at the magazine since 2012. He has also written regularly for numerous other outlets, including The Wall Street Journal, The Times, The Sunday Times, The Sun, The Evening Standard, and The New Criterion. He is a regular contributor to National Review and has been a columnist for Standpoint magazine since its founding. He is the author of several New York Times and international bestsellers, including Neoconservatism, Why We Need It, Bloody Sunday, Truths, Lies, and the Savile Inquiry, about the Bloody Sunday Inquiry, The Strange Death of Europe, Immigration, Identity, Islam, and The Madness of Crowds. Welcome, Douglas.
Very good to be with you.
Yes, glad to have you here. Congratulations on the success of your book. Doing very well, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. I'm pleased to say it's been a bestseller in many countries, and it's always wonderful for a writer when you're read, which isn't always the case.
That's absolutely right. I mean, your book has been out since September 2019, correct? Yeah. What have been some of the notable reactions to your book so far?
Well, in a way, the most interesting reaction is that it's landed so comfortably. The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity is about the hardest, most sort of difficult, toxic, you might say, certainly controversial social issues of our time. I do them chapter by chapter, gay, women, race, and trans. And I don't do them in an attempt to sort of flamethrow or something. I do them in an attempt to pick apart and demonstrate the problems with a reigning orthodoxy that we have or have fallen into. But one of the striking things to me about the reception of the book has been how enormously much warmer it has been than I feared it might be. To sort of paraphrase the phrase Lady Bracknell, I mean, or to alter Lady Bracknell, you know, to tread on one landmine might seem a misfortune, but to tread on at least four looks like carelessness. Actually, despite jumping around the landmine field of our time, I've been so struck by the fact that the reaction has been so warm, which suggests to me that there are many more people out there who want to have sane, reasonable, adult discussions people from right, left, center, no political standpoint at all, than some of us had feared. And what it suggests, among other things, is that the very vocal and vociferous minority of people who are pushing some of the agendas that I describe in the book are certainly a minority and may now indeed be on the back foot.
Yes, that's very interesting. Because I mean, one of the things you talk about in the book a lot is the speed of the changes that have been going on. Perhaps maybe there's a speed of change in the opposite direction. Perhaps the pendulum might be swinging back. I don't know. Anything changed, do you think, between the time of publication and now?
A few very positive signs, yes. Tiny little incremental things. But I think that the era of people trying to shut down discussion simply by naming it as a phobia of some kind is coming to something like an end, because, you know, we're in an amazing era in communication. And it's true that, as I say, a vociferous minority can make themselves heard disproportionately and can have a disproportionate muting effect. Once people see through that, there are so many people now who just, you know, we can all find things out for ourselves. We don't need intermediaries of the media, of the old media, and much more. And when people try to find things out for themselves and do find things out for themselves, they discover that issues that are being presented to them as if they were incredibly simple are much more complex than we're pretending in our societies. And that's one of the things I try to demonstrate in the book, is just let's not lean so hard on these heuristics that we've basically only come up with a few days ago. Let's just be a bit more humble about what we don't know and a bit more assertive about the things that we all do know, or at least all did know until the day before yesterday.
Yes, yes. So perhaps from what I'm detecting in the tone of your voice, even, and the subject of what we're discussing, is that perhaps you're a bit more optimistic now than when you were actually writing the book. Am I right?
Well, I mean, the point of the book was to, in part, it was to pick apart this social justice ideology, this thing that calls itself social justice, which masquerades as social justice and actually causes unbelievable social division by weaponizing identity groupings against each other. I wanted to demonstrate how it wasn't going to work in order that other people had to spend as little time as possible enmeshed in this ideology. And yes, I mean, I am to some extent. I mean, I was quite optimistic when writing the book, because as I said there, I didn't think it could hold. I don't think that things are visibly contradictory, such as, for instance, the idea that gender is a social construct and people can choose to be women, and the only people born in the right bodies are trans people who are born in the wrong bodies. Yeah. I didn't ever think that would hold, because too many people, not least women, who comprise 50% of the species, know it not to be the case. And so, yes, and I'm very heartened by the fact that more and more people, particularly actually women, as it happens, are speaking up. It's an enormously positive sign.
Yeah. Now, a lot of the audience of New Books, the New Books Network, are university people, lecturers and students and whatnot. And this is where the origin of much of the social justice ideology emanates from, and what you're arguing against. And if we want to have a civilized, good faith dialogue with people on the other side, you know, maybe some of them, you know, well, the well-meaning ones, because there are certainly ones who may not be well-meaning, but the well-meaning ones, you know, they would have thought that, you know, this whole movement was to make the world a better and less oppressive place. And perhaps they might be disheartened that the pendulum might be swinging back. How would you address them?
Well, I think it's very important to say that what we are, I think, or have been going through is something that might be thought of as an overcorrection. So, for instance, nobody can, or I think nobody sane would deny, that there has been, and still is, some homophobia, for instance, in most societies. I think nobody would deny that women and men have not been equal throughout history or been treated equally. I think nobody would deny that racism hasn't existed, and that in America in particular, the racial legacies of the past still have enormous repercussions in the modern day. I don't think anyone would deny that. But in the process of trying to correct that, it's possible that we go into something like an overcorrection. And the point then I urge people to think about is, how would you know that you have overcorrected for long enough? Who would tell you? Who would lead you back to equal? And what I mean by this is, for instance, and you see this in movements like the whiteness studies overreach, which originated in the American Academy, which is to say that this is a very, very clear overreach. All other forms of studies, gay studies, I happen to be gay myself, and I think that there was a utility at one point in gay studies because it sought to bring out writers and historical figures who may have been to some extent covered over in the past because of their non-heterosexuality. You could certainly say that Black studies has had a role in bringing figures, highlighting figures from history who needed to be inserted into the canon where they rightly deserved to be. And then you get this thing of whiteness studies, which is entirely designed to, quote, problematize whiteness. And this is clearly an attempt to in some ways make up for historic racism by turning racism against white people and being racist against white people. It's a clear overreach. And I think a very good example of something that is absolutely fatal for anybody interested in genuine equality. Because anyone interested in genuine equality should know that equality means just being exactly the same as everyone else, being treated exactly the same as everyone else. Not, for instance, treating one group of people as better because of something they have no say over, such as sexuality, race, or gender, and treating no group as inherently worse because of that. And so one of the things I just always urge people to do is to consider, are you absolutely sure, if you're on board with this ideology, that this ideology, which is so prone to the resentful tone, is not actually an ideology which is making things far worse?
Yes. Yeah, you mentioned in the book, and now that, you know, we're some months into the publication of it, we can discuss the real world unraveling of it, perhaps. But you talk about cognitive dissonance, the fact that, you know, people are asked to agree with something they don't actually believe. You know, they're bullied into, you know, accepting various positions that they cannot, you know, really accept. But you know, and it's almost like a situation of the emperor's new clothes, where you're afraid to say certain things. And now you've mentioned that it seems that there we agree that there seems to be some sort of retreat, I suppose, in public discourse, but you know, the let's say the corporate aspect, the universities, the workplaces which enforce these things, do you see any retreat there?
It's quite important that we don't, of course, get stuck on universities in this, because to some extent people are turned off by the universities thing, because basically most people expect that liberal arts colleges in the US in particular are going to be places which produce crazy and unuseful ideas. You know, I mean, it's sort of, nobody is surprised if you say there's a crazy idea that's come out of Berkeley. So, you know, it's important to stress that the problem with this is the spillage over of the last decade in particular of these very untried ideas that have spilt over from elements of the American Academy into the real world, and specifically, I think, into the workplace. This is an absolutely fascinating one, by the way, so-called woke capitalism. And again, it's one that I think people should be instinctively deeply suspicious of. When you see large multinationals jumping as auditioning-like as possible on the sort of woke gravy train, I think people need to question much more, why might this be happening? And is it a good thing? Now, of course, a lot of social justice activists think, hurrah, the big corporations, the big companies are coming on board with our ideology. I look at it in a different way. And it seems to me that if you look back over the last 12 years since the financial crisis, one of the things that's most striking is the banks and large corporations that took risks which at the very least contributed to the near crash of the global economy in 2008, had a range of things they might have been put through and gone through as a result of that. The cheapest way imaginable for them to try to claw back some respectability is to jump on the new morality that the social justice activists purport to be leading. And let me give you a couple of examples of that. There's an obvious one with a bank in the UK I won't name, but which during Pride Month, Gay Pride, LGBTQ plus Pride Month each year now, festoons its branches across the UK with the rainbow flag and the logo Love Happens Here. And I reckon that's the cheapest way for that bank to try to avoid any responsibility for its own actions in the last 2 decades, is to glide past the responsibility that they have as an institution and get away with some of their worst potential behavior by saying, look, we're onto all the gay stuff in the biggest imaginable flag-waving way. Let me give you another example. The coffee chain Starbucks. There are an awful lot of critiques you can make of Starbucks, from the terrible quality of their coffee to their tax arrangements. Starbucks has, in recent days, as it happened, jumped on board with a trans children, a charity that advocates for trans children called Mermaids, a highly controversial trans charity in the UK, and is raising money for them with a special mermaid cookie, 50 pence of which, the sale of each one, will go to this highly controversial child trans charity. Again, what some people would like to think maybe is, terrific, we've got Starbucks on the trans wagon now. I think another interpretation might be needing to be put on this, which is, no, this is simply the cheapest way Starbucks can come up with to launder its public image. And so there is an inbuilt propulsion to companies, large corporations in this era, to do things which are exceptionally easy for them, actually, and are demonstrations of an evasion of a bigger responsibility because they've decided to mask any bad behavior with this votive offering to the religion of the time.
Yes, yes, I think that's an excellent analysis. It's a question I wanted to ask you, in fact, about, you know, how you explain the alliance between, you know, the largest corporations in the world and these supposed Marxists. I think that's an excellent and very interesting explanation for that relationship. It aligns you with the old left, you know, like George Galloway just launched a new party, the Workers' Party of Britain, where they are totally against identity politics, because this new left, this post-Marxist left, which you were talking about with Laclau and Mouffe and so forth, every identity is allowed except your economic class identity. You know, and
yes,
absolutely,
yes.
Convenient, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting phrase, identity politics, because, of course, there is a critique of it you can make, a critique of using it in the way that people like me do in our critiques of it, which is to say, well, you're simply playing different identities against each other, and it's just you don't like this one. So, for instance, a criticism of people coming from my position is sometimes, well, you know, you don't mind playing nations against each other, or a country identity, and indeed you encourage it, but you don't like it when gays are used against straights, or men against women and women against men, and so on. And there is something in this, of course. And one of the questions I have for people about this is that since there will always be identity groupings, it's worth working out which are more desirable than others and which ones would appear to cause more friction than peace. I think one of the most dangerous things about the identity politics, as I describe it, is that it categorizes people by immutable characteristics, innate characteristics, that is, things about over which they have no control. So, you know, nobody chooses to be born a man or a woman. Nobody, I think, chooses to be gay, and nobody chooses to be black or to be white. These are just things that are characteristics we're born with, and which, as I say in the chapter on race, we'd rather hope by now we would at least be sort of moving away from finding them to be in any way the main thing in our lives. There's an awful lot more we need to be doing with our time, working, apart from anything else, to steal a line from Martin Luther King, working on the content of our character, for instance. But the identity politics, as I see it, doesn't do that. It gets us stuck constantly on these characteristics and groups people accordingly. And the problem with that is, of course, is that grouping people like that, among other things, doesn't allow anyone to leave. And it doesn't allow anyone to join. And one of the things to do with national belonging, at any rate, which, my goodness, we know has its own problems. But one of the things to do with national belonging is, of course, that it can, in its better manifestations, be precisely the unifying factor that a society needs. It's what the late conservative philosopher Roger Scruton described as the first person plural of belonging, the we. Who is the we? So there are different forms of belonging. And class, yes, you're right, is one of them. I think, I would, maybe you wouldn't be surprised to hear this, I would differ from George Galloway's analysis of class politics, not least actually because I think that a lot of this has come about because of the disappearance of class politics, which isn't necessarily to do with anything more sinister, simply than the disappearance of class as a signifier of great note in our societies.
Yes, yes. I guess that debate gets us, I suppose, see, the old Marxists are materialists. And so for them, that, you know, and everything else is a false consciousness and designed to mask your material exploitation. And so from that hardcore Marxist point of view, everything that takes away from the realization of one's material deprivation, your gender, your sexual orientation, your race, all these things are false consciousness. So I guess that would be the Marxist response to...
Yes, the Marxists always had an explanation for everything other than the question, why is it that every society you've ever had to run always ended up being a total slum?
Absolutely. And that could take us to another point. There are a few questions I wanted to raise from various sides, and I have to manage the time appropriately because we can go on for hours for what I want to talk about. But I think a lot of times you've been probably critiqued from the left, let's say, and you've had to defend yourself from that side. So why don't we try something else and a critique maybe from the right? So For example, there are about this alliance between the Marxist social justice warriors and the corporations. There are some who have talked about, and this would be actually a sort of anti-capitalist right, a kind of a neo-reactionary, old conservative right type of thing, where this SJW phenomenon is a form of social control through, you know, creating chaos and fake identities, shallow group identities versus real historical communities, and it's part of a corporatist destruction of traditional identities and traditional communities. Do you think there's anything in that critique at all?
The corporations are deliberately doing it in order to drive people apart. No, I don't see that because, as I say, I think it's just very clear that they are the followers onto this bandwagon rather than the leaders. It's true that if they do it in significant enough numbers and with significant enough economic force, they might be able to do far more than any group of ideologues at a West Coast university. But no, I mean, I think it's provable that they come to the party late, and therefore are clearly not, they didn't come up with this themselves. You know, it wasn't like Goldman Sachs came up with unpacking the knapsack, one of the central, from the 1980s texts of so-called intersectionality. But can it have the effect of driving people apart? Obviously, is that effect magnified extraordinarily once it's done by large global corporations? Obviously, yes.
I mean, people have pointed to the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, and so forth. But you make a good point about definitely.
By the way, so I should add, all of those foundations, there's a fascinating thing about all those foundations. It's a very reliable rule. Every foundation named after a large industrialist or other, you know, large capitalist, within a generation or two, always ends up campaigning against precisely the thing that made the wealth, that made the foundation possible. It's a totally reliable thing, so that all of these great oil money families now, you know, campaign against all fossil fuels.
Exactly. And here's another sort of critique from the right about the. Let me explain my critique from the right, because what it seems to me, and you can verify this or confirm it or not, your argument is kind of like an argument about fighting for liberalism in a sense. You know, who are the real authoritarians? Who are the real racists? Who are the real freedom lovers? You know, and that, you know, the contemporary left has gone too far, and that you're arguing for a kind of, I don't know, a 19th century liberalism, a classic liberalism, a centrist liberalism, however you wish to define it. Would you say that's a fair characterization of your position?
A more common one I hear in a related critique is you want to go in the same direction as the left, just at a slower speed.
Is that fair?
It's not an entirely unfair analysis. What I say is that it seems to me that, to use a somewhat loaded term, in the dialectic of our societies, the way that it ought to work, ordinarily has worked, is that broadly speaking, and again, these categories are becoming somewhat useless, but let's stick with them for the time being, that ordinarily speaking, the left, for instance, will present a social justice unfairness and will seek redress for it, and the right will oppose it. And some people think of this differently. My own view on it is that this is a perfectly reasonable war of attrition, whereby the conservative instinct effectively acts as a corrective body to the lunacy that is originally suggested. And that this makes, of course, over time, this means that conservatives are forever fighting the next battle they're going to lose, but it's not quite losing. It's coming to a more a reasonable accommodation with a plausible rights claim. That's what it's important to remember, with a plausible rights claim. So the enormous difficulty of what's going on at the moment with the trans issue, which I do the last chapter of my book on, and do very carefully, I hope you'll agree, as I try to unpick what is actually happening here and explain it, and where is the reasonable rights claim and where is it totally unreasonable. This needs to be litigated and debated in the public square very, very carefully and openly. And what's so interesting about it at the moment is that the left as well as the right are finding it very nearly impossible to have the discussion that they need to be having, because they are being shut down from it. And one of the warnings I put about that is just no good can come from this. If we'd insisted that people were not allowed to talk about the civil rights movement in America in the 1950s and 60s, the civil rights movement probably wouldn't have been successful. You know, so I do think that the dialectic, to reuse that difficult term, is both necessary and useful.
Yeah, because that's an you know, it's an important point and certainly a valid one. And you know, I'd like it, because the more, let's say, hardcore conservative. I mean, you I suppose are a neoconservative, as you've written, which is.
Well, I don't really like these labels, I have to say. I find them
exactly.
Sort of useless.
And it describes things to you that may not be right. But if I'm just using that shorthand just for convenience, and where it's inapplicable, let's certainly discard with it. But there is a critique that, you know, that this, where we've reached today, this madness is inevitable. Since it's inevitable from the movement in the 1960s, when traditional society was unraveled, that we were definitely going to reach here. And, you know, some neo-reactionaries, you know, say, you know, back to the French Revolution, you know, it was going to inevitably lead here, you know, that the slippery slope is real. You know, I doubt that is your position. My understanding from your position is that, you know, you do think that, you know, well, the French Revolution and the Enlightenment and you know, that liberal, you know, birth was a good thing for Western civilization.
Well, I don't. I'm not a particular supporter of the French
right.
Revolution, but the Enlightenment, of course. And it's been the greatest gifts that the world has got, that that reason ended up having such a voice
right.
in the discussions of recent centuries, of course.
Yeah, because one of the things you mention in the book as generative of the very problem we're facing is the Lyotardian problem of the collapse of all meta-narratives.
That's right.
And which is basically kind of a restatement of what Nietzsche talked about, the death of God. It's basically the same thing. And that nihilism.
Yes, it's sort of an extension of
yes,
the point.
And,
yes,
and that nihilism is the inevitable result. And so this is where the old conservative, I suppose, criticism comes in, that once you take those traditional mores away, we are inevitably going to be seeing this. Because I suppose the reason why I'm harping on this is because I'm a little bit older than you, and in the 1990s, when I was, you know, in university at that time, the same culture wars were happening. I mean, Camille Paglia was the big, you know, I love her. She was big on the scene at that point. And, you know, they were talking about date rape, and they were talking about, you know, reparations and the very, very, very same issues. And one, you know, it's one wonders, is this sort of an eternal cycle, the pendulum coming back and forth? Or, yeah, I'd like to hear your views.
No, my own view is what you've just described is an extension of something which has been going on for decades. It's part of this spilling out of, as I say, a small section of academia in America into the wider world and finally into the corporate world. But that's a sort of chartable process. I think that what you describe as what you describe when you refer to what I write about Lyotard and indeed Nietzsche, it raises one of the most interesting conundrums, which is that a critique of this, which Nietzsche saw or foresaw, was that people might try to go round again. Now, what I mean with this, with the specific conflict we're going through about where values are rooted at the moment, is that I'm very struck that there is a sort of neo-reactionary, you might say, particularly religious expression that is going on in certain countries more than others in the West, which says, yes, we will return to, for instance, our Christian roots and so on. But the bigger problem is the one that Nietzsche saw, which is you can't fake that. Even if you wanted to. And we're here because history has happened and because a set of discoveries have occurred. And we can't, as I said in my previous book, In Strange Death of Europe, where I wrote more about the fundamentals of this, we can't unlearn what we've learned. And this makes a segment of the pushback against, you know, everything from Nietzsche through to the present day to be sort of futile, really, because, as I say, outside of a relatively small number of people, people are not. There is not an argument saying, yes, our values are ungrounded, and therefore let us reground them in belief in God. I mean, there are people trying to do bits of that, as I say, but it is striking that that is not the main conservative critique of this. And there's a reason for that, which is that the people who might do that sense that it is unworkable because they don't believe it themselves. But this is where we get into the true problem of what Nietzsche foresees, which is that we are stuck in this mechanism and there is no way out, and there's no way out from our learning. And This is a catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. I understand. I think that's right, and it doesn't present us with easy answers at all, you know. And because, see, what I see you doing in this book, you make some, you know, very strong arguments and points about, you know, that these issues are not closed, they're not settled, about gays, women, race, trans, and you wonderfully highlight highlight various issues as to why we still need discussion, why we shouldn't shut it down, you know. But in the world as we find ourselves, the opponents don't seem to want rational argument. You know, they don't want to hear your argument. It seems like.
And, well, let me dig down, if I may, into one of the reasons why of that. Let's go a level beneath this. It seems to me that the reason for that is very deep indeed. This is what they believe in. This is what they intend to spend their lives doing. They sense that it isn't sufficient, but they don't allow anyone to open up that chasm for them. So those people...
It's existential.
Yes, those people who have been persuaded erroneously, I think, unwisely, I think, that meaning and purpose in life is primarily found in waging wars of rights acquisitions on your own behalf and on behalf of others who you may not know, is a bad conception of how to live a meaningful life. and that there are people who start to intuit this. There is, I might say, there's a very ugly corner of this, but we might as well open it up, which is women who realize around the time that they are no longer able to have children, that they were in some very fundamental way lied to by the era. Now, you don't want, if you are a person in that situation, and it can happen to men as well, but there's a closer to the boat one that women have for obvious reasons. They do not want to be told that actually what they were told the deal was is a deal that isn't true. They don't want to hear that. And what will happen is they will double down and dig down. By the way, there's fascinating work done among others by Cass Sunstein and others at Harvard about what happens in our brains when we come across a correction to a fallaciously held view that we have. And it isn't that you say, oh my gosh, I've been so wrong. It's, as lots of people who've been in long-term relationship or marriages will know, it's that you don't concede, you double down, you hold on to it harder. And I think it's clear that many of the people who've adopted this as their purpose and source of meaning in life are not going to offer it up, because underneath it is a chasm and total personal chaos.
I think you're absolutely right. It delves, you know, into deep psychology here. I mean, you know, if anyone has ever had an interaction, you know, with this type of opposition, there's something deeply psychological going on.
Do you see that these protests, particularly that happen in America, which in places like Seattle and perhaps most famously Portland in recent years, you know, you see these people who are screaming at enemies who are not actually what they say they are quite often. People they have, for instance, identified as fascists because they need fascists who may be unpleasant people and worse, but who they soup up into bigger enemies and scream. And what you see so often in these displays are displays of deep existential meaninglessness. I mean, literally howls.
Yeah. You know, like when the day of, I can't remember what they called the day of rage, when they were all screaming at Trump's re-election. Yes. Let me see if I'm right in characterizing your critique of the SJWs, of the woke people, that you essentially see this as Marxist, correct?
It's a part of it, certainly. It's fed into it in the same way that a form of sort of red ideology is fed into part of the green movement across the West as well. But I don't say it's solely responsible for it.
Right.
It's a very significant tributary.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I see this just replaying the culture wars of the 80s and 90s. Alan Bloom's Closing of the American Mind, I think, is very instructive. And this is, I see it like a Nietzschean power struggle, right? And just like how Bloom talked about this very paradoxical Nietzscheization of the left, because he was not left in any way, shape or form, but you know, there's this revenge fantasy. There's the resentment, and there's this weird transvaluation of all values from this leftist point of view. And yes, it is existential, as you are you know, alluding to. You didn't use that word, but basically, it's like, as you rightly say, it's like a battle for battle's sake.
Yes.
If you want to elaborate on that?
By the way, you're citing Bloom is very interesting, because, of course, there's one aspect of this which Bloom, citing Bloom in a way, counteracts one thing I'm saying, which is that this is getting worse. Because, of course, what Bloom saw when he was on Cornell was in some ways worse than things we've seen in recent years. I mean, when Bloom was teaching at Cornell, you know, he saw a gun being pulled on campus, and he never quite got over it, actually. And he saw there that what I think of as probably the most crucial conservative with a small c realization, which is how thin the veneer is between order and chaos, between civilization and barbarism, how near we can always be to that border slipping, eroding, being traversed. And so Bloom had that in his day. One of the things he saw about this, of course, was also the Americanization of some of this. I mean, he has, I think, in The Closing of the American Mind, he has that very, very perceptive point that, to some extent, the American version of Nietzsche ended up being a form of nihilism, but which was nihilism with a happy ending. It's an exceptionally perceptive observation, this, that what we are talking about in many of the movements I'm describing in The Madness of Crowds definitely fit into that. These are nihilistic movements that expect a happy ending. And there is something specifically American in that. It is quite different from a form of, for instance, French nihilism, which seeks, advocates for, and expects no such ending.
Exactly. Yeah. We've been talking around the core arguments of your book, and largely just because I know you've spoken about it for so many times, and I don't want bore you with regurgitating the arguments, but you do have some important recommendations and solutions. To get there, we need to understand what some of your arguments were. So why don't you highlight for us some, because I'm sure there would be listeners who may not know the substance of your argument.
Well, the main thing is that I say that this ideology that is being tried out everywhere has not demonstrated that it can work anywhere. That the foundational game of intersectionality is provably wrong on its own terms. Firstly, because none of the groupings are actually stable entities in themselves. For instance, we don't actually know what being gay is. We lean on it increasingly hard in our societies as a source of ethics, meaning, and more, but we don't know what it actually is. We pretend to be more sure than we are. Obviously, something very similar is happening with trans. Whereas there are things...
Can you elaborate on that a little?
Yes.
That we don't know what gay actually is?
Well, let me give you the most obvious one. We don't know what causes it. We don't know how it comes about. I find this quite interesting myself, because leaning on something the origins of which you're still kind of uncertain is unwise, because you may put so much pressure on it that it snaps. There is every reason to argue for equal rights. But what I describe as happening in recent years has been effectively an overturning of the stool, so that the products of rights become the foundational rights. That is, that women's equality, gay equality, racial equality, and more come about because of liberal rights. But if you upend the barstool and try to make these products of rights into the origin rights, the foundational rights, the fundamental rights, you end up with this deeply, deeply unstable structure that we're all perching on at the moment. Because, as I say, we keep pretending we know more about things than we do. And at the same time, paradoxically, on certain of them, particularly to do with relations between men and women, we pretend that we don't know things that we know. So that, for instance, relations between the sexes have been so toxified in the public square in recent years that it's not even possible to say things, or has become highly dangerous to say things, which everybody knew to be the case until yesterday. I give an example, which is predatory women. This is such a well-known thing. It has been a source of comedy, of tragedy. It's existed in every genre for millennia. And only now do we have to pretend that no such thing exists. or do we have no place in the culture for referring to it? This makes our discussions on these things incredibly difficult to have whilst pretending that we've actually sorted it all out. So I'm urging for, among other things, humility on some of the things that we don't know very much about, particularly on the trans issue, in order that we don't end up snapping the products of rights which we enjoy. Another point about this is I'm very keen, I demonstrate for people to realize this, is that this game doesn't work on its own terms, because not only are all of these things contradictory and more difficult than we pretend within themselves, but between each other, they are very demonstrably contradictory. For instance, trans rights runs totally against gay rights, and it runs very significantly against equal rights for women, as I say, an increasing number of gay people and women are starting to notice. Now, that's interesting to me, because these things are all presented as if they come in a group. You know, I'm for trans rights, I'm for women's rights, I'm for gay rights. What if it's not as straightforward as that?
Might I also add immigration from, let's say, Islamic countries where women's rights are far, you know, less than in the West. So you're pro-immigrant and pro-feminist at the same time.
Yes, this is a whole set of at the very least highly contradictory ideas that are being presented as if they are all on a continuum, all come in an easy one-size-fits-all package. And I think this is... this is something which, as I say, deserves to be critiqued. There's one other thing I'd add on that, which is that the games that we are being invited to play are unwinnable games. I refer particularly to the subsection of this, which is the privilege game, which has become so overwhelming. I heard the Archbishop of Canterbury, the head of the Church of England, talking last week at a conference of the church about his own privilege and the privilege of people in authority. And you know, it's a fascinating, unwinnable game, because as I urge people to remember, there is no way from one hour to the next of calculating where people actually stand in the privilege hierarchy. We cannot play the game because we cannot actually know. And being invited to play unwinnable games is, among other things, something which I am against, not just because I try to demonstrate why they are what I describe, but playing them comes at a massive opportunity cost. Because if a society is embroiling itself in playing unwinnable games, we won't get around to things that we ought to be doing, or we could be doing, or indeed to problems we could be solving. You know, I was speaking with a friend the other night who happens to be a medic by training. And he said to me, you know, we were discussing this very issue. And he said, you know, we don't even know what we should eat. And it's a very good, very striking point. It's not a meaning issue, but it's a very interesting procedural and life issue. If everybody decided to, you know, apply their brains to working out actually what for which metabolism and so on was the optimal diet, for instance, you know, you could certainly save a lot of people. You could save people or give people a lot of years. But we don't apply ourselves to all sorts of really quite obvious questions because we're playing unwinnable games, such as, have you benefited from privilege? You know, how the hell do you know?
Yeah, that's like, what's that famous thing? Did you beat your wife last week? Or
when did you last stop beating your wife?
Because I mean, this is a thing that obviously has been thrown at you and will continue to be thrown at you by critics, saying, well, you're exaggerating the problem. You just see it as a problem because you're defending your old privilege. And this is where the sort of, the Nietzschean will to power of you know, the resentment comes into play. And yes, it's as if there is no, you know, no meeting ground, no rational place for discussion in good faith.
No, I mean, because, I mean, among other things, I don't do this, but I could. If a person were to make such a critique, and I hear it occasionally, then I could easily turn it around to them and say, well, you just want power. Mm-hmm. You just want power.
Yeah.
You are asserting your demands because you want power. Now, this is a very reductive way to look at people. But when people claim, for instance, to be the most oppressed person in the room, what is it apart from a power grab now?
Yes.
What is it?
Exactly.
It's a demand to be given the megaphone because you're the biggest loser, allegedly.
Yes. It is precisely what Nietzsche described in The Genealogy of Morals and the sheep and the transvaluation. It's precisely that. Mm. It's precisely that. It's quite amazing. Yeah, so I mean, what we've observed at the beginning, we were seeing how the pendulum does seem to be swinging back. Mm-hmm. There seems to be some, you know, your work hasn't been greeted like, say, what happened to Milo Yiannopoulos or Ann Coulter with all these riots in America. Have you toured America?
Yes.
Speaking about
I should stress, by the way, sorry, just maybe I'm oversensitive about this, but one reason is that I'm nothing like Milo Yiannopoulos or Ann Coulter.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I mean, it's
that's
very right. important. I mean, I'm not flame-throwing. I'm genuinely, yes. You know, I'm a thinker, I'm a writer. And I'm not a partisan. I'm not arguing for a particular point of political view. I'm urging people to join me in thinking more deeply and carefully about building in a system of values to our society which hasn't worked wherever it's been tried, which is almost nowhere. And so if the reaction isn't as much fire, it's because I think I'm taken rather seriously, if I say so myself. I am read and critiqued, and I have, you know, readers and also, you know, people who admire my work from across the political spectrum. And that's because I'm not going in to just throw grenades around and then leave the room, you know. My work consists of a call to moral seriousness apart from anything else. And so that's one reason why it lands perhaps more softly, as well as the fact, as I say, that I think that I'm now speaking to a much more receptive audience than existed even 5 years ago.
I mean, you do at the end of the book present a list of very, you know, fine, reasonable solutions in your conclusion. Could you go over some of what you think are the most important?
Well, you know, one of the things that I invite people to do is to try to come to a more reasonable estimation of the society that we all live in. I'm based in the UK, but I'm in a different country every week, somewhere in the world for work. And it's been like that for some years. I get to see an enormous amount of the world. It's one of the great joys of my life, one of the great blessings of the job that I've ended up doing, being a writer. But, you know, one of the things I urge people to do is don't present societies where you've never had it better as places where it's never been worse. And I say this particularly, I think, to young people in countries like Britain, America, most of Western Europe, certainly North America, is work out where you actually are historically as well as geographically. And this isn't to say don't ever demand anything more. You know, you've never had it so good. It's not that. It's to say compare your situation, compare what you're being asked to do with other places and other things. So I say, whenever anyone says, you know, we live in the most oppressive, you know, patriarchal, hierarchical, et cetera, et cetera, always ask compared to what, compared to where, compared to when. Because because apart from anything else, what we might be going through is a consequence of fantastical historical and geographical ignorance by a specific generation, particularly a generation of Americans, who just don't know history or geography or anything about the situation that they are in comparative with any other time in history.
Yes. I would like to add something here from my own perspective, because I did grow up in Canada, and I did my PhD in the UK and so forth. My heritage is West Indian, and I'm of Indian, South Asian, Hindu background. And I know that, so you have these immigrants or first generation people who are so strongly critical of the UK or Canada or the United States, but they don't want to go back to their countries of origin,
right?
Because they instinctively know they want to be in these countries.
Yes,
but they present it as the worst things in the world. And
that's very interesting you say that, because I one of my friends in London is a headmistress and says that. If whenever a child is taken back to their country, their parents' or grandparents' country of origin, they always come back better behaved. And the reason is that they see their first or second cousins and the situation they live in, and they realize their own proximity to that, and therefore how comparatively lucky they are. It's a very interesting thing that.
And there's some sort of performance going on.
Yes.
It adds, because I think.
What do you think that performance is about, can I ask?
Yeah. It is, I think there's a huge identity crisis.
Mm.
And people looking for a place, because in my own case, I experienced exactly what you talk about, but I decided to go back. And even though I wasn't even born in the West Indies, and all my relatives told me I was crazy. Why would I go back when everybody wants to, go up, to these countries? And, I had a very different, set of concerns and values. I was very nationalistic and whatnot.
Mm.
I see it in the reverse case. I see my second cousins or my cousins and whatnot living in the States, living in Canada or even the UK and whatnot. And I see that there's this profound identity crisis.
Well, that's certainly the case.
Yes.
Yes.
Just go on.
Well, what you described there is a belonging problem, because of course one of the massive mistakes that we've all made in recent decades is the presumption that if your financial well-being, if you're fiscally better off than you were, this covers over all other problems and questions. And it's just not the case. It's true that societally, going back to what you said about the French Revolution, societally, an awful lot of cracks can be covered over so long as the going is good with the economy, which is one of the reasons, as you know, why I talk a little bit at the beginning of the madness of crowds about what the delayed impact socially of the 2008 financial crash may have been, which is what we're going through. But what you describe is this massive papering over of a set of cracks, which is just because you have a mobile phone and your grandparents didn't, it doesn't mean that you are rooted on this earth. And this is why the proffered types of belonging have to be thought about, interrogated more deeply than we are willing to do currently. You see,
I'd like to just, share a story, because I had the honor and privilege of launching my book on politics in the House of Commons in the UK. And so when I, you know, and I was living here, I had already moved and whatnot. And so when I went up to the UK, and I have a lot of friends lecturing in universities up there, and they're all left wing, you know, social justice types. So they reluctantly had to admit that it was a great honor, that, you know, that was, that I had. But then they had this, you know, kind of lingering thing in the back of their mind. And then they would, you know, they would tell me, but don't you think it's just too British? And I would respond, no, this is perfect. This is exactly what I want. I love it that it's so British. And I wish back in Trinidad, we would have things that were more Trinidadian.
Right.
And they were so at a loss, because they don't want to go back to their own countries, and they resent the countries they're in.
Yes.
And this is a real problem.
If
they don't admit that to themselves, it prevents good faith dialogue. Yes. That's all they wanted to add.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. This is why we have to work out what the deeper roots of meaning ought to be and what the most legitimate forms of it consist of. And, you know, I have a shorthand for this when I say to people sometimes, if you discover you're gay, it's not a replacement for religion. You know, gay is a category error to make that mistake. It's not going to be the source of meaning in your life. It'll be one of your sources of identity, potentially, to a greater or lesser extent. But it's not going to give you meaning in your life. So be very careful, very careful, not to fall into that that false choice or that false idea. And the same with each of these. The same with each of these things. Being black may be an aspect of somebody's identity. It may be to a greater or lesser extent, but it cannot be meaning. Just as being a woman. You'll notice, by the way, in each of these, I skip the ugliest one, because, of course, if I said being white may be part of your identity to a lesser or greater extent, we would all cringe slightly, including myself. I wouldn't want to do that, and that's for interesting historical and other reasons, moral reasons. And again, depends on where you're standing, where you're coming from. And again, you'll notice that I say that being a woman may be a part of your identity, but I wouldn't lean on that very heavily. But I'd be careful about saying, you know, your identity as a man, perhaps less so than on the racial one. In any case, I mention this just because these are category errors which we are being urged to slip into. And really, really what we have to ask the whole time on this is, what would be the discussions we would be having of meaning if we weren't playing these unwinnable games? And I come back to this issue. You know, there's one that I actually mentioned earlier, Camille Paglia. There's one that I cite from Paglia about motherhood, where she makes a very interesting point that I pick up on, which is why did feminism skip motherhood? Well, there's a reason, which is, it's such a difficult question. It's so difficult to work out how a woman should be able, as she should be able, to fulfill herself in her career if she so wants to do that, and at the same time become a mother. It's not an obvious, easy one, although we often presented as such. And as I say, and Camille Paglia says, maybe we got onto all of these sort of vengeful, often zero-sum issues like wage gap because we couldn't cope with the motherhood discussion. And as I say, in all of these things, I do urge people, why don't we work out what we should be doing with our time?
Yes. Yes, I mean, those are very important points, and that's a very important issue in terms of putting something, if I was to put it, something smaller to substitute for something bigger, you know.
So,
and it's not,
or something. Let me, or another. Can I put it another way? taking something, accepting something which is tinny instead of something rich.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And as we avoid discussions of meanings, then we get into these noisy power struggles and avoid meaningful conversations about life itself. And this is kind of what's happening, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you had to sum up your I don't want to say the book, but your argument, you know, what is the heart of the case you're making? If you were just to sum it up in a couple of sentences to close off.
The heart of the case is I'm trying to urge people, particularly young people. I'm very lucky in having a lot of young readers of my books. Particularly it's to young people to say, don't fall into the trap you're being invited to fall into. Don't waste your life. This is why you shouldn't. This is why this thing you're being invited to waste your life on is not fruitful. And it is to invite people to do that, to spend as little time as possible on this in order to get past it and get on to the things that they and we should all be doing.
That's great. Do you have anything, any upcoming books or engagements or
that's very kind of you asked. The paperback of The Madness of Crowds with a new afterword comes out in May. I am also on tour, including in North America and in and around the UK. I'm doing a 12-city tour, I think, in the UK in May and June. And the dates for that and the venues for all of these ones all around the world are always on my website, which is douglasmurray.net. And all details are there on the events page. And I should just say how much I look forward to meeting members of your audience at these events, because there's always a chance for questions, disputation, argument, much more, and a chance to have these and more discussions out in person, which is the bit of my life that I really enjoy.
Yes, that's excellent. If I can get a chance to go out and meet you, I'll try to do that myself.
Really hope to see you there.
Great, great. Well, thank you very much, Douglas. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. Thank you.
That's all for New Books in Politics this week. If you like this, remember to check out my other podcast, Independent Thought and Freedom, and subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, if you are an academic that wants to get heard nationally, check out my free training at becomeapublicintellectual.com. Thanks, and see you next week.